your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left, rich and a farmer. Father, son, left a cameo, blue denim, had his vein.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So today I came across an article that it's one of those things where you go, yeah, maybe this is an idea. Abolish the court, the Supreme Court as a whole. Maybe that could solve our problems. Or, you know, maybe a different way of appointing court justices. Because as Joshua Holland writes in his piece on the possibility of abolishing the courts, you know, whether you believe that, you know, gay marriage or the social issues are being rammed down your throat by one set of justices, or on the other side, campaign finance laws are being thrown out and unions are being busted, the court just seems to have become this political tool. And I'm sure it's always been this way. I'm sure people have made this argument for a while. But the question then becomes, you know, how do we get back to where, you know, maybe we didn't remember the justices' names. Maybe nobody knew who they were, which is why I've asked Joshua Holland to come talk to us about his piece over at Raw Story. Josh, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rick.
So abolish the court, huh? Is that an idea? Is that a possibility?
You know, I think that it's more of a repeal and replace situation. you know, I did put a kind of clickbaity headline on it, but my point here is that with the very blatant maneuvering by Republicans the last 3 years, first holding Antonin Scalia's seat open for over a year to keep Obama from appointing a justice, and now ramming Brett Kavanaugh's nomination through, I think that a lot of people have kind of opened their eyes to the fact that this court, as it's currently structured, is untenable. So you hear proposals from progressives like, we'll take back that seat by packing the court, by expanding the number of justices, for example. And I think that we need to step back, and as long as things are that had been settled are up in the air, take a deeper look at how we can kind of reimagine the court. You know, the Constitution is rather vague on the specifics. It says that there will be one Supreme Court that oversees is the arbiter of disputes between the states and the federal government, constitutional conflicts that arise. It doesn't really offer a lot of specifics beyond that. We have this current process where, you know, one party, the party that holds the White House basically nominates somebody. 5 out of 9 with lifetime appointments can have a veto power over laws that are enacted by a Democratic legislature. And, you know, they're completely unaccountable. They're insulated from both popular opinion and elite opinion, and they're partisan. They've become more and more partisan as we've become more polarized. So I said, look, let's take a step back and kind of rethink the whole process.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, you hear the stories of past justices where you had, you know, a minority party, you know, giving input into who would be acceptable, because it comes back to, you know, once they broke the filibuster rule, once they broke the 60 vote rule, that basically, in my view, you could put any crazy person on the court as long as you had a one vote majority.
That's right. And there have been a dramatic increase in 5-4 decisions over the last 20, 30 years. The court is certainly not working. And I get back to this thing that court packing won't address, that term limits by themselves, which I think are important but insufficient, won't address. And that is that this third branch of government that was supposed to be an ostensibly neutral arbiter is now just another partisan branch of government. You know, you have these two branches, the executive and the legislature, by nature, are always going to be partisan, and we should figure out ways to make the Supreme Court less so.
Yeah, I mean, that whole balancing act that we're supposed to have. And, you know, I always think about, you know, I went to George W. Bush's presidential library, and the one thing that my kids remember about the library is that they had a triangle on a little ball, and it was the balancing of powers. One corner was the legislative, one was the executive, and one was the judiciary. And you were supposed to take this piece of wood and balance it on the little ball. And the problem is now that you have complete control by conservatives, there's no balancing. They have all the power and can ram through whatever agenda that they want. And I don't think that, you know, well, one, liberals aren't thrilled with that, but I don't think conservatives want that either, because eventually that pendulum will swing, and then you have these wide variances of law and policy and winners and losers. And I don't think that's good for the future of the country. You may want, hey, our team won today, but, you know, down the road, I think it's a horrible thing.
You know, I said in the beginning of this piece that this is one of the very, very few things that people across the ideological spectrum should agree on, because, you know, long before the court took its rightward lurch, when it had, you know, the kind of what progressives think of as its golden era in the 50s and 60s, you know, they were the ones who were complaining about five unelected tyrants in robes.
Activist judges.
You know, we should all find the basic structure antithetical to a democratic republic. You know, again, it's the idea that five partisans, you know, you go through this whole rigmarole to elect a Congress, to elect a president, to do politics, and then a president who can serve only 8 years maximum gets to shape the judiciary for, you know, if Kavanaugh,
generations,
for 40 years, you
yeah.
know, 30 or 40 years. It's something we should all find, you know, contrary to the basic tenets of representative democracy. And
yeah.
So what I said in this piece is, And I intended this piece to be kind of be a conversation starter. I don't have it all thought out, but what I was thinking is, instead of saying let's have like 11 justices, let's pack the courts, which, by the way, there's nothing stopping them from then coming back and
repacking
the courts again, right?
Sure.
When they regain power, is let's make it that we have a congressional body, bipartisan, that selects a large group of potential justices for the president to select from. And these justices are chosen for their legal acumen, for the quality of their jurisprudence, for the quality of their legal scholarship, if they're scholars. And then let's have the president appoint 30 members, let's say, to the Supreme Court, and let's randomly choose 9 or 11 or whatever number to hear each case. So you don't have a predictable, you know, court where you say, oh, there's 5 conservatives and 4, you know, progressives or 4 moderates.
So you're kind of having an idea of a pool of kind of like a lottery pool of justices who will hear each case.
That's right.
Kind of like a jury pool almost. Of, you know, we'll pull these couple and that'll be out. I also like the idea of having an even number as opposed to an odd number, to where if anything changes or anything, it's decided someone has to move to the other side, or someone has to. So you have to actually have some compromise in there.
Yes, I like that. The other way to do that is to make a supermajority if they're going to overturn laws. So, you know, you say, okay, well, you know, you can't overturn a law 5-9. You need 6-3. This would allow the court to have its basic function of protecting rights from infringement by the legislature. But it would say, okay, you're going to have to convince somebody from the other side to go along with you. Either way that you achieve that, I think that that's important. I think that another idea that I thought. And I think that these people should have 8-year terms, staggered 8-year terms, so that, you know, it's predictable that each president will nominate 5 or whatever it is. And I think that they should make the decisions anonymous for a period of years. obviously historians and you know, legal scholars need to have access to who wrote what. But in the moment, I think that they should be able to make decisions that don't comport with their party or their ideological preferences in a way that won't lead to blowback against them.
Yeah, but how would that work? How would that work? I mean, because I'm someone who's big on transparency, but you know, you're generally going to the court with some hot button issues. We'll take the Masterpiece Cake place, for instance. You know, how would you keep that quiet? How would you not know what the decision was immediately? Or are you talking about who decided it?
No, I would, you have to publish the decisions in full. I would say, let's keep the authors anonymous while they're in the court. And this allows them to be more flexible ideologically than if they feel that they have to rule in a way that is consistent with the president who appointed them.
Do you think that's possible? I mean, I look at someone like Kavanaugh, for instance. I you know, he's been groomed since, you know, in utero, I would argue, to be this, you know, this right wing, you know, somewhere near Thomas kind of conservative. It's in the breeding. It's in the, you know, the entire, you know, path to get him here. Is there a way for him, you know, the leopard to change his spots? I mean, is that possible?
Well, I think that the thing that we're not talking enough about with Kavanaugh's nomination, you know, amid the charges of sexual assault and allegations that he perjured himself and stories questioning his, you know, financial, his debts and...
Yeah, who paid that off? I want to know who paid it off.
Dollars worth of baseball tickets, all of this stuff misses a fundamental thing, which is that Brett Kavanaugh should not be considered for the Supreme Court because he's a Republican political operative. He's a particular kind of attorney. He is trained in the law, but he has this history of being a political operative, a partisan political operative. And I would think that in that first stage where you have a panel of, you know, retired judges and retired legal scholars and a bipartisan panel that vets the candidates first, they should reject somebody with that kind of background, right? They should look for people who have, I mean, we should figure out a way to assure that what we have at the Supreme Court is the country's leading legal minds, the most well-informed, you know, intellectually nimble, et cetera, the best lawyers, rather than the most dedicated partisans.
No, I'm with you on that. I mean, there's got to be a way of doing that. But, you know, some of the stories that I've heard, I mean, you know, Bill Clinton evidently asked Republicans, you know, who they would be able to, you know, to get behind, and ask for a list of people that said, hey, you know, people that I would go for and that you'd be acceptable to. And, you know, to me, that seemed like, you know, almost the right thing to do. You go, okay, well, you know, I'm going to appoint somebody that I agree with. You know, is there someone that you know I agree with that we could come together on? That seems to be the way that I would like to also see things happen. Although in this polarized political world now, I don't see that happening.
Yeah, I mean, that was a different time, and that was a time when there was a lot more respect for, you know, the unwritten norms that made Congress more or less functional. I mean,
right.
not it was never a great body, but more or less functional. I think that by making a much larger pool of jurists, you know, if you say we're going to have 30 members of the Supreme Court, what it does, and we say, okay, and they're only going to serve for 8 years, what that does is it lowers the stakes to the point where neither side needs to actually, you know, advance fierce ideologues. And the idea would be that if you have this rather large pool of really top-rated, top legal minds, you know, internally there would be a culture that developed, one would hope, where they would privilege open-mindedness and, you know, intellectual heft.
Yeah, it sounds like a great idea. I just don't see... I don't want to rain on the parade. I just don't see conservatives giving up the power that they've now attained. And that, look, you know, generations of big money and, you know, organized power on the right, you know, along with, you know, all of the think tanks and state policy networks and the Federalist Society, all of, you know, the years of get wanting and dreaming about getting to this moment, I don't see them ceding power. I just don't see it.
I also don't see them ceding power. I see this as, you know, if we're going to talk about packing the courts over their objections, which is an extremely aggressive political move in the first place, then maybe we should, offer that as an alternative. You know, you can sit down with us and imagine a way that this court fulfills its, you know, what the purpose for which it was designed, or we will ram through these two other judges and just put you in the minority.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there are, I share the frustration with the way that they handled Merrick Garland, and I think that and then Gorsuch and now Kavanaugh, I share the frustration that is causing people to say, let's pack the courts. I think that, you know, if we're going to go and consider a radical move, then maybe we should consider a radical move that takes this kind of partisan edge off of the court in the first place.
No, I'm right there with you, because I remember the first person who said, well, when we take power in 2020, we're just going to expand the court. And I'm going, but what happens in 2024 if you lose? Don't they just expand the court?
Also, when you do that, you make it more likely that you're going to lose.
Exactly. Because always my fear with law, and I believe in decided law. Once the rules of the game are set, you figure out how to live by them. If you're constantly changing the rules, you constantly have chaos. And this swinging pendulum is bad. I mean, it's a sign of every banana republic around the globe, of which I would prefer not to be one.
Yes, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm offering this idea, and I'm going to probably develop it in a longer essay, but as an alternative to consider, if and when Democrats retake power with a lot of anger and frustration, instead of just, you know, saying let's pack the courts and deal with it in this short-term battle, let's really think about reshaping it so that it isn't a third partisan branch of government. We have one kind of, and, you know, I think there's a lot of different ways you could go about this. I offer some ideas in this piece, but there has to be a way to make it an institution that is above the political fray, that goes beyond uncodified norms, which we have seen can be just blown away.
Yeah, well, we want it to be the umpire that John Roberts originally said he would be, and ultimately now you've got Kavanaugh saying he would be an umpire too. I'd like to see them be the umpire. Pretty simple to me. But Josh, great piece. I hope it does spark the conversation that I think as a nation we desperately need, and that is how do we rein in the power of these activist judges on either side, wherever you believe it, how do we make it a true and fair arbiter of our laws? But good stuff, and I hope it does do that, and I'd love to have you back as this continues.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate it.
Good stuff. As always, Joshua Holland. You can check out his piece over at Raw Story. We'll make sure we tweet it out so folks can take a look at it. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.